And an expectant hush.
It's probably a sign that we need to get started. Thanks so much, everybody, for coming. It's excellent to see you at this meeting this evening, which has been called by Media Workers Against the War. Since we called the meeting, events have moved quite quickly, really. And one of the ideas behind calling this meeting has been because Media Workers Against the War, we feel that media workers ought to be in a position to be able to respond quickly to events, in particular events in the media. My name is David Crouch. I'm the chair of Media Workers Against the War. I work as a news editor on the Financial Times website. Before that, I worked for several years in magazines in EMAP and CNP and other places. And we have tonight for you a panel of some of the most well-informed, outspoken, and committed commentators on and in the media in this country, and I'm very glad to welcome them. But this meeting is very much not just about listening to great speakers. We're very much very concerned that we I hope that you will come out of this meeting feeling that it's worth your putting some of your time and some effort into campaigning around this issue. We want to take not just the anti-war voice, but the facts, the arguments, the perspectives, the people generated by the anti-war movement in this country into the editorial meetings in the British media up and down the country. Not because we expect the media to become anti-war, no, but we expect the media to cease being so pro-war and to take the arguments seriously, to take our arguments seriously. And that means being active, being involved, those people of you who are in the media yourselves or are interested and want to campaign around the media. One of the themes of tonight's meeting is going to be just how we can do that most effectively and how we can make our voices heard. And really, it should therefore be appropriate that we start the meeting with a speaker who will be familiar to many of you who have been on the massive anti-war demonstrations, whether it's Hyde Park, Trafalgar Square, or outside of Parliament. She's the convener of the Stop the War Coalition, Lindsay German.
Well, thank you very much. And I'd like, first of all, to bring greetings from the Stop the War Coalition to this meeting, because I think that the question of the media and the war and the related questions is one of the most important things that we can discuss. And it's a question that we feel we fought on one front for the last 5 years now, since the war in Afghanistan, then the war in Iraq, the whole build-up to the war in Iraq, and then the catastrophe of the occupation that we've really seen since then, that we've fought on that front. But of course there's another front as well, and the other front is how we can operate as people who work inside the media, as people who have some connection with the media, to try to establish some truth, some objectivity, some alternative view from the one that is very, very often given. And it's very easy, I suppose, for those of us who have campaigned against these wars to really see the media coverage as lies. You know, it's very, people say very commonly, the Prime Minister lied, the papers lie, Rupert Murdoch lies, all this kind of thing. And I've no doubt there's an element of that in it, and we can discuss, you know, the... Can you not hear me? Okay. All right, sorry. Can you hear me now? If I lean, okay. Sorry, but you only have to look at what is happening with the media to see it isn't just simply lies. We did have the Evening Standard's claim that Saddam and his weapons of mass destruction could hit us in 45 minutes. We did have those sorts of claims. But in a way, what's much more disturbing about the coverage of the war is the ignoring of the things that are going on, the refusal to cover, the failure to cover, sometimes the inability to cover, as is the case in many parts of Iraq and Afghanistan today. And people have read the wonderful book or seen the film All Quiet on the Western Front by a man called Eric Maria Remarque, who wrote this after the First World War. And he got the inspiration for the title from a headline in one of the German papers, which said, "Invest in Nicht Neues." In other words, nothing to bother reporting. even though, this was by 1917, even though soldiers were dying every single day on the Western Front, but it wasn't worth anybody reporting these facts. And it seems to me, when you look today at the small piece of news, I don't know if people saw it, that the consulate in Basra, the British consulate, is removing some of its staff to Basra Airport because the old Basra Palace, where the consulate is situated, is simply too dangerous for those staff to work in it. Now, this is something that, unless you followed this very closely, unless you're an Iraqi, unless you're an expert, unless you look at all these kinds of questions, or maybe unless you're a diplomat in the British Foreign Service, you wouldn't know that this was the case. You wouldn't know how dangerous it was. You wouldn't know that any of these things are happening. And we can report this. The fact that the Americans last week said that they've lost control of Baghdad, and they tried to regain control, but they didn't succeed in doing it. All of these things are things which really tell you that we're not getting the kind of reporting that we want to get. Sometimes the military restrict people from doing it. Certainly often the news organisations don't regard it as a priority. And it is a very, very serious problem for us in terms of the way in which the thing works. But of course there's another side to it as well, which I'm sure other people will talk about tonight. I just want to refer to it briefly, which is that we have a war at home as well. We have a war at home, a government which wages war on Iraq and Afghanistan, also wages war on the people who have opposed the war here, and in particular the attacks on civil liberties that we've seen, and the onslaught on Muslims in the media, coming from government ministers over the last few weeks and months, is part of that war at home. You know, when I read about the one example, the Forest Gate brothers, the two brothers who were whose house was raided, tiny little terraced house in Newham, who had 200 police who came to raid their house. One of them was shot in the process of the raid. The whole of the house was taken apart. The neighbours had to move out. The family had to move out for weeks and weeks and weeks. They're only just now back in their house. And when you look at what was said about that, you had these huge headlines the day after they were arrested, that they had chemical vests, that they were planning a chemical bomb, whatever a chemical vest is, but we were told by all the newspapers this is what they had, that they were dangerous people. A week later, after they'd been in custody for a week, they were released without charge. This hardly made the headlines of the following week's papers. It hardly made the front pages, I think, of any of the newspapers. And that building up of this climate of fear, a climate where the war on terror is something that is dealt with not by looking at the real facts, but by looking at the way in which the domestic population is attacked, is something that we're seeing more and more. And it seems to me that those questions are very, very important questions for us, and particularly for people who work in the media, who have any access to the media, who have any influence over the media. It seems to me these are questions that we have to deal with, because we are now reaching a point where they've lost the arguments over the war itself. Nobody now believes, apart from George Bush, Tony Blair, and no doubt a few ever self-selecting a smaller group of people who advise them, nobody now believes that the war on Iraq was a good idea. Fewer and fewer people are believing that we can really win what I think is an unwinnable war in Afghanistan, and that means that they are turning on the domestic agenda much more. Now, tomorrow, and again you won't have read this in your newspapers very much, there's a debate in Parliament on the question of the Iraq war. Now, don't get too excited, because you perhaps should get excited, because this is 3.5 years since we've had a debate on this terrible situation, and that in itself is an incredible fact. But of course it's not called by the government party, it's not called by the main opposition party. It's called by two small parties, the Scottish Nationalists and the Welsh Nationalists, the parties which are given a day every few months to have these debates. Tomorrow they're having a debate and we're going to have a demonstration outside. But this is something which tells you, in a way, the complicity of certainly the national media and the people at the top of the media, that we haven't had this debate and nobody bothers to question it. I guess it won't get very well reported tomorrow. Maybe I'm wrong, but I guess the Labour MPs will stay away, lots of the Tory MPs will stay away, and then everybody will say it wasn't really much of a debate. And yet this is a question where 62% of people in the poll last week believe that the troops should be immediately withdrawn from Iraq. And that tells you the gap between what the government wants us to think and what their friends who own the media and the top editors of the media want us to think, the gap between them and what the people on the ground, the people who've campaigned against the war, the people who can see the destruction that the war is doing, who can see that we could spend, there are many, many things that we could easily spend our money on and spend it on much, much better. So that is the situation we now have. I think we have grounds for hope, however. I think, firstly, there are many, many very fine journalists who do try to challenge the accepted view, both the people who have columns and who have access to columns, although most journalists don't have that kind of position, but also what the people at the Daily Star did when they said they weren't going to print the Islamophobic front page, and where they said, we are not going to have this paper used in this kind of way to, and let's face it, the Daily Star has plenty of racist stereotypes at certain times in its coverage, but to stand up against that I think was a very courageous and a very brave thing to do, and I hope that we can all take heart from what those people have done. But these discussions and these arguments and this attempt to not forget what is happening, to remember, for memory to triumph over forgetting, is something that goes on and can go on every day in offices and newsrooms around the country, and that is one of the points of having the meeting tonight, and that is why I welcome the meeting so much tonight. And just the other point that can give us heart is this, that despite what the media says, despite what the government says, most people don't believe them on this particular question. That despite their constant attempts, despite the fact that you would think if you only watched Newsnight or you only listened to the Today programme, you would think that really the vast majority of people had only had a few sort of quibbles about the war, and it's only when the head of the British Army says that the British Army are doing more harm there than good, that suddenly being against the war is a respectable mainstream kind of thing to do. That's the way that they project these things. When you look at what we have now done, despite the Today programme, which wouldn't even take anybody from Stop the War on the day that we had 2 million people marching on the streets of London because they said it wasn't relevant to their thing, their agenda. The fact that we know that the BBC didn't always make sure they could get pro-war voices in all these times, and the fact that the Hutton report, I think, has seriously caused problems in terms of the BBC even reporting in the way that they did during the time of the war. So there are all those questions, which are very serious questions for us, but also let's take heart from the fact that despite the government's best intentions, despite the spin doctors and despite their allies inside the press, the best of the journalists and the best of the people who read the papers or listen to the radio or watch the television don't believe what they're saying, can see beyond the stories that they do, although they don't put out, to the truth that is going on. And that is a great encouragement to us. So I would just like to conclude by saying that we'd like to, for people to come and join us tomorrow outside Parliament if you can. On the 18th of November, we have a conference, what we call the People's Assembly, again, which is entitled Islamophobia and the War on Terror, where we're going to discuss the links between what they're doing to Muslims in this country and what that has to do with the wars that they're waging abroad. And we hope that you'll do everything you can to support those. On the 11th of November as well, we have an Armistice Day for Afghanistan and Iraq, which will be, we'll have the military families outside the cenotaph the day before all the politicians go there. So we hope that you will join us on any of those activities or any of the other activities that we have. But most importantly, we hope that this meeting will inspire you to campaign to make sure that the truth gets out there and to make sure that whatever the people that you work for, whatever the people who run the newspapers would like to happen, that we can begin to set a very different agenda.
Thank you, Lindsay. And I believe Lindsay's got another meeting to go to after this. So thanks again for finding the time to come to speak to us.
I think many of us will have had the experience of seeing an article or report that we believe is biased. But quite often the response of the media is to say, well, we published another article at another time or another report which showed the other side. And this is why academic research into the overall picture that the media paints is so important. And so I'm very pleased to welcome our next speaker, who's Professor Justin Lewis from the Cardiff University School of Journalism, whose team has done a tremendous amount of research into the media coverage, British media coverage, of the invasion of Iraq, which appeared in this book, Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Professor Lewis.
Thank you. I want to make two points, really, this evening. The first is a point that comes out of the research we did for the book. The research was begun on the basis of a commission that came from the BBC after the Iraq War. Greg Dyke suggested that some independent research was needed to look at the whole issue of embedding, as a number of people had begun to have a few doubts and qualms about the embedding process. So we were asked to do some research into that. And the research we did covered a lot of bases. We looked at coverage, we spoke to journalists, we spoke to the Pentagon, we spoke to the MOD, we did surveys and so forth. And I won't even begin to try and summarise some of the things we looked at, really just to make one point that comes out of the book. And that is to do with the nature of the coverage and why it changes and why its political character changes. I suppose you could say that the coverage of the Iraq War went through three quite different phases. The phase before the war began was at least relatively open. A number of different stories were told. The debate was reasonably wide-ranging. The same can be said for the period after the war was over, at least after the war had been over for a few weeks, a couple of months. But during the war itself, and the period immediately before and after, when we looked at the coverage, we found that during that period, coverage really closes down. Coverage became it was much less about a whole range of stories and much more about really one story. And the only story that was really told during the war itself was the story actually of the war. How was the war going? Who was winning? Who was losing? How were the battles being fought? Was the war being won? And so forth. And the reason for that is partly because news media tend to focus on the sort of newsworthy aspects of battle. That's totally one reason. But another reason for that was because of the widespread embedding program that the Pentagon in particular, but also the Ministry of Defense, vigorously pursued. And I think that the thinking behind that program is something that should give us all pause and make us think about the nature of covering war and conflict. It was clear from our discussions with the Pentagon that they were no longer thinking about the media coverage of war in terms of the old model of censorship. You know, they were no longer thinking that the way we get good coverage is to clamp down journalists and stop them talking about things. They, if you like, had moved way beyond that. They were now thinking very much in terms of public relations. And public relations teaches you very early on that, you know, the way you get good coverage is not just by stopping people speaking, it's by promoting discussions and stories that you want told. And the story that the Pentagon wanted told was a story of a war being won successfully and quickly by US-led forces. And that was the story that was told up until the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein, that famous iconic moment. And in that sense, it was extraordinarily successful. Public opinion, which was against the war beforehand and against the war afterwards, during the crucial stages of the war itself, was in favour of the war. So it was a kind of a moment of validation during a key period. And I think, I mean, one of the things that we were struck by when we spoke to journalists about the coverage of war was the sense that the main problem in dealing with the military is a problem of censorship. The military is essentially seen as knowing quite a lot, far more than in fact they do. Often, I mean, we found intelligence within the military to be very clunky, and often, you know, various people within the military knew far less than journalists did at any given point. But the assumption is that the military know a lot, and they're just not telling us. So the question is one of access and one of information. And so when the embeds were given a great deal of information, which they were, the assumption was that was no longer a problem. And so I suppose the point that we would make in the book is, is that what journalists need to do is move beyond that model. That it's no longer about censorship, it's no longer about not being told what's going on. It's as much now about questioning when you are given information as questioning when you're not. In other words, if you are suddenly given access to a lot of information, you have to begin to ask, well, why is this? Why is this happening? And one of the things that we found was that the story of the war itself obliterated all other questions and stories during the weeks of the sort of main stage of the war. Questions about the aftermath, questions about the efficacy of the war, all those questions disappeared completely. The second point I want to make is about the media coverage of terrorism. Whenever we look at the way in which issues are covered in media, one of the things that becomes abundantly clear early on is that there's often not much relationship between the volume of media coverage of an issue and what's going on in the real world. Crime is a great example. If you want to know how much crime there is at any given moment, then reading the papers is not going to tell you. Now, the reason for that, and that shouldn't surprise us, I mean, news doesn't focus on the typical. So why should it be a good arbiter of various trends? And one of the things that we were interested in looking at was that true of terrorism? So we did something very simple, really, which is to compare the volume of terrorism over the last 20 years with the media coverage of terrorism over the last 20 years. Now, the first of those things is very difficult to measure. So we took as our measurement the US Department of State's own data on this. And the US Department of State, up until 2005, published data for the last 20 years on the number of international terrorist incidents around the globe. Actually, it's amazing how few people actually went and looked at this. It was on their website. Very few people actually looked at it. And one of the things that's very surprising about that data is that it almost completely contradicted the kind of messages that were coming out of the White House and elsewhere. What that data showed very powerfully is that the volume of international terrorism around the world from about the mid-80s onwards has steadily declined. In other words, there are fewer terrorist incidents. So, for example, the years of the last 20 years with the fewest international terrorist incidents were 2002 and 2003, years in which there was a huge volume of media coverage of that issue. Whichever period you look at, you find mismatches. 1986. 1986, there was a huge upsurge in media coverage of international terrorist incidents, and yet there were fewer incidents that year than there were in 85 and 87. So there's not really a great deal of relationship between the two. And what we see in the coverage of terrorism is, on the whole, a gradual decline of terrorist incidents, also the volume of incidents. Actually, over the last few years, the year which had the highest number of terrorist casualties, according to the State Department, was 1998, not 2001. There were more people killed in 1998 than 2001. And yet the assumption is that the peak year was 2001 and things have been at a high level ever since. That's what you find from media coverage. That's the way media coverage looks. It's been a huge upsurge in 2001 and it maintains itself at a high level and has ever since. But in fact, there is a substantial mismatch between that and the only data that we have available. So I suppose one of the things we begin to need to do is to think seriously about looking at the data that lies behind those headlines and thinking about whether the huge upsurge in the reporting of terrorism actually relates to something going on in the real world or not. And I would suggest the data suggests that, in fact, surprisingly, it doesn't.
Thanks very much. And Justin mentioned the issue of embedded journalists. You might be aware that the Ministry of Defence has banned ITV News from embedding its journalists with British troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is a time when, as you know, discontent in the army about what they're doing in the war on terror is at a height. And in this regard, Media Workers Against the War has issued a statement today, which you might find actually underneath you on your seats at the moment, calling for the ban to be lifted and for free access for journalists to British troops abroad. And I'd encourage you to take copies, which you'll find out on the table at the back of the room afterwards, and to gather signatures of work if you can. Our next speaker is a very experienced BBC
Middle East correspondent. He was a correspondent there, I think, for over 15 years, from the mid-1970s, and writes and speaks widely on the Middle East and the media, and is now a freelance journalist, and also on the executive board of the Council for Arab-British Understanding. Please welcome Tim Nguyen.
I want to start by telling just a very brief story about myself, not because I'm indulging in ego journalism, which is very popular these days, but it does illustrate a much wider point about the BBC. And I harp on the BBC because I think it's pretty obvious to all of us who work in the media that the BBC is probably the most important single institution in Britain as regards transmitting and gathering news of international matter. And most people in this country do get their information, for better or for worse, from BBC News, and mostly from BBC television. In fact, you could say about BBC that the more intelligent the coverage, the more minority the programme. In other words, in my experience, BBC television news is probably the most, is probably the worst offender in terms of truly balanced coverage of the Middle East, whereas if you tune into the World Service, say in the middle of the night, or perhaps to some aspects of Radio 4 late at night, you might find something approaching a decent and balanced coverage. But my point is that most people watch television news either at 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock, and some, of course, the Today programme, which we've already mentioned, which I think is very lax, is also terribly important. So it's to these programs I'm really addressing my views. Now, over the past, the story about myself is very briefly this. I covered the Middle East for the BBC for on and off 15 years as a staff correspondent, 10 years as a Middle East correspondent, and then another 8 or 9 years as a freelance contributor. Around 2000, I suddenly discovered that a memo had been put out by BBC management about me, not to my knowledge, but I found out, of course, it's one of those dozens of journalists, that a memo had been put right saying that if Tim Llewellyn ever appears on the BBC to talk about the Middle East, it is to be made clear that he was never, said or mentioned that he was in fact a BBC correspondent. In other words, the organisation I'd worked for 21 years was disowning me. Now, I am not a member of the British National Party, racist, anti-Semite, I do not have a dog in the fight in the Middle East. My campaign, like the institutions which I work with, the Council for Arab British Understanding, Arab Media Watch, and I work on my own behalf, has been purely and simply to try and get the standards of Middle East coverage, the fairness and justice of Middle East coverage, improved, especially by the BBC. What we found, and this is enough, it seems, to have excited the Israeli and pro-Israeli lobby to the extent that they have actually campaigned against people like me in the BBC on the grounds that we are somehow beyond the pale. And it's been effective. This is the point, not so much the point of what happened to me. It doesn't bother me that much. But the point is that the BBC is a very frightened organization and has been extremely frightened. It's all been frightened, but it's been very, very frightened since the year 2000. When the new uprising, the Intifada, the armed uprising began, and the situation in Palestine and Israel became extremely fraught and extremely dangerous and extremely violent. And the Israelis wildly overreacted by sending their army into the occupied territories and carrying out the most appalling atrocities there. And equally, the Palestinians replied by using dreadful suicide bombs. A debate we don't want to get into here, but it's from that date, the Israelis decided, and their friends, of whom they have many and who are very proud, decided that they would never make the mistake again that they made in 1982 and lose the publicity battle. They exerted extraordinary pressures on the BBC, and the BBC has been a nervous organisation ever since. What we found, and many reports, for instance, Greg Filo's very well-known, very analytical report which was made 2 or 3 years ago at the University of Glasgow, other reports from other institutions, as with findings from Cardiff, and other Strathclyde University, I think it is, many other organisations and think tanks, have found basically that the BBC's coverage is not pro-Israeli in the sense that there's some vast Zionist conspiracy going on and lots of Jews sitting away in a room somewhere in the BBC orchestrating coverage. That's not true. It never has been true. Conspiracies in the BBC do not work and never could work. I worked there long enough to know that. However, there is definitely an imbalance in the reporting, partly caused, I think, by extreme pressure. The BBC management does not like being shouted at and screamed at and accused of being anti-Semitic. Nobody does. But when you have nervous suits running big organizations, big corporations, like the British Broadcasting Corporation, then these tactics seem to work. But more than that, there is still, I think, inside the BBC, and probably in most British cultural institutions, which should by now be knowing better, given the makeup of their staffs, the makeup of their readerships, listenerships, and viewerships, there is still, I think, a cultural lag here somehow going on, in that people still regard the Arabs, or the Arabs in particular, but Muslims in general, as the other, as something alien, as something foreign. Palestinians aren't people like us, Israelis are people like us. Israelis go to supermarkets, drive four escorts, and go on holidays to the beach on package holidays, and they sing in the Eurovision Song Contest, and they play football with Liverpool. This kind of, this matters, this makes people feel familiar and at ease, and therefore the image of trouble, of suicide bombings, which are dreadful incidents, but the imagery of people like us being damaged to state with official paramedic ministers, the proper police forces, the proper army, this carries a resonance with people in this country, which, seeing similar actions taking place on the Palestinian side, do not have one. And one of the main problems I think the BBC has had, and it was identified in a report which came out earlier this year by an impartial panel, which was appointed by the Board of Governors, and much of which I agreed with, and we all agreed with, was that the BBC was not reporting adequately on the conditions of the Palestinians and the suffering the Palestinians were undergoing in the occupied territories. To put it very simply, if you do not report day by day from those areas about how those people are treated under occupation, there are many other issues, but this is a basic one. If you do not report from there on these conditions, then you are not explaining the context or the background for why these people behave the way they do, why suicide bombers exist, why armed opposition goes on towards Israel, why the Palestinians are so aggrieved, why indeed the Palestinians are fighting amongst themselves. If you do not explain that, and the BBC has not explained adequately, then you are leaving half the story out. There is a spurious equivalence of work, as I call it in many articles, a spurious equivalence in that there are two sides in this dispute. The Israelis on one side and the Palestinians on the other. And somehow they are equal, and they've both got white on their side, and they've both got wrong on their side. And this ignores the report by this independent panel agreed with this. It ignored the fact of the Palestinian conditions, it ignored the conditions of the Palestinians, but also it's an example of how this kind of cultural misunderstanding operates. We're not telling them the full story. And there is no equivalence, in effect, between the occupied and the occupier. And that's a terribly important point, which I don't think the BBC's reporting has yet addressed completely. Now, we haven't got much time. There are many other areas I could go into. We found, it was also found, much of which we suspected and found out with our own analysis, of Greg Filer's famous analysis, found it, but the Board of Governors agreed with it, with more findings by more think tanks and their own observations and going on the evidence with people like me and the Council for Outreach Understanding and Media Watch, that the Israelis have given far more time to explain their case on the BBC than the other side. In terms of actual officials, on the mainstream bulletins of the BBC, the Israelis and the Palestinians were fairly level playing. But when it came to generalized comment, when it came to people other than official spokesmen, the Israelis won the day in at least four or five separate categories. They far outdistanced that number of the Palestinians in terms of putting their case across. Another major lacuna, in my view, is the fact that both in the recent Lebanon War, during the Iraq War, and the most continuing Palestinian crisis, which has been going on for many, many years now, the BBC should know better, We do not hear adequately the Arab voice, we do not hear the Iraqi voice, the Palestinian voice, the Arab view of these conflicts, which are taking place in Arab territory. There are many other points that perhaps will come up in questions, but very broadly, I think the encouraging news is that broadly, the Board of Governors, this impartiality review, did shake up the BBC. And it's very valuable for the BBC to have this report, to fight back against the lobbyists who threaten it, menace it, and generally frighten it. And there are signs the BBC is beginning to take some notice. I'm not terribly happy, I was going to talk to you about a little bit about the film that was put out about Iran and Israel the other night, which is a totally biased, absolutely disgraceful film, which we aren't complaining about officially. If you want to ask me about that in the rest of the extra time, as it were, I'll talk about that. But the BBC has promised that it will appoint a permanent correspondent in the occupied territories for the first time. We hope to give them as bigger voices as the voice we hear from Israel itself, or from what part of it, from West Jerusalem, which is de facto Israel. And there are signs that the BBC is beginning to mend its way. So I'm not totally depressed, but I will say this: it does show that pressure works. What I'm asking you all to do here is to realise that what we try to do is not what the friends of Israel and Israeli lobby do, not scream and shout and moan and curse and threaten and cajole. What we want to have and what's worked for us is intelligent, thoughtful, analytical criticism and praise where praise is due. We're always very careful to send emails and messages to the BBC when they do something good, and they do. Last week's report from Afghanistan by Freya Joyner was an extremely good report. It was upset the Tory party and the Labour party were that good. That's what we want. Let's upset all these bloody people. But give praise where it's due, but be on to them. And I can tell you for one hour, there's names, emails, numbers, people to call. Keep the pressure up. It's a slow process, but it does have an effect in the end.
Thanks very much, Tim. And I should have said at the beginning that if we have time, we will fit in some questions and contributions to the speakers from the floor. Our next speaker probably won't need much of an introduction to you, because you'll know her through her columns in the national press. In an extremely powerful column in last week's Independent, about a week ago, she compared Bush and Blair's war in Iraq to the final scene in Shakespeare's Henry VI, Part 3. Where Edward IV is soaked in blood on the battlefield, but doesn't realise that he's soaked in blood. And in the same way, Blair and Bush are so besotted with themselves that they can't see the bloodstains on themselves, that what they've done to the people of Iraq is at least as bad as what Saddam Hussein did to his own citizens, and that they should both be in the dock in The Hague answering for these crimes. She is Yasmin Alibaybani.
Apologise for turning up late. And I only speak as a flawed practitioner, because one of the important things about what we've just heard, is it not on? Yes. Thank you. Is that all right? Is one of the most important things, it seems to me, to keep in our understandings of various conflict situations is ongoing, sober research, not the mad rants of columnists like myself, which are of the moment. But here are some observations anyway. I think one of the things that I have only begun to understand properly, because I'm still an outsider really, is how the patriotic spirit comes alive when a war is declared. And it's almost an instinct in most British people, indigenous British people. And when that patriotic spirit arises, the first time I kind of witnessed it but didn't quite understand it was, of course, during the Falklands era. But this time, there was this build-up, very conflictual build-up to the war. Everybody knew that we were divided, angry. Many of us, I would say most of us, knew it was a completely, in my view, a criminal adventure. And yet, when it started, almost like a starting pistol, we had to go into patriotism. And actually, it's very difficult to go into patriotism if you have very strongly held views about an unjust war. And I think that is part of the reason, besides the kind of very clever PR stuff and what you described so well, that there is a kind of mood that takes over. And it's almost, I should never forget, being foolishly on a Question Time program. I was right fit up by the BBC then. I mean, if ever there was a fit up, and they denied it, but afterwards Greg Dyke more or less confessed it in his book. But it was this fit up because every Question Time was turning out to be anti-war. And of course, the government was getting more and more. Campbell was getting hysterical. And so they almost had to design a Question Time, actually create a Question Time, breaking all the rules of the program itself, to make a pro-war Question Time, which they did. And they did it in the most extraordinary way. But what I hadn't, and I said what I believed, which you do. They put this woman next to me. I'd done a lot of Question Times. I'd never had this experience of one person sitting uncomfortably close just to me. They put me at the end there. And before I could my third sentence, she was at me saying, I was raped, I was done this to, I was done this to. You're a supporter of Saddam Hussein. Here, do you want to see, do you want? And, you know, what do you do? What do you say? And every time I opened my mouth, this woman would go for me. So finally I said, excuse me, you know what? Please don't emotionally blackmail me, I have a view. Well, that was it, wasn't it? Because the kind of patriotic fever, plus this very interesting setup Question Time, my goodness, you know, if they could have killed me and hung me out to dry up there, they would have. The letters were all about, when we are in the situation going into war, you people can never be patriotic, you people meaning, I suppose, of slightly darker skins. That's something I think I've really learned about. But the other thing, and I want to, maybe this is going against the trend of the general thrust of what has been said so far. I'm actually incredibly proud of the media over this war. I really am, with all the reservations that I have about it, because we didn't let it die when the government wanted it to die. We never let it go off the pages. We never let them go even 2 days without somebody standing up to remind them that the war's still going on. The war wasn't over when the statue fell. The war isn't over. The war carries on. And I think with such a powerful, hawkish, pro-war lobby in the media, including, of course, ex-lefty friends, who shall have to remain nameless, but we know who they are, who even now haven't said, some of them have begun to say, mea culpa, we should have not fallen for this, but others have got even more gung-ho about it. With all of that going on, we, in the media, in spite of all the obstacles, kept this thing going. And I think, with all the kind of arrogance of New Labour, that they could push this through on spin like no other government had, we beat them. And I think we should feel proud sometimes of working in this media. We beat them. We did not let them win that particular battle. And I feel incredibly proud of that, because the cost personally for me and many others has been immense. Immense in terms of lots of stuff. I don't want to go into that. And just as examples of how at key moments when the thrust was upon us to go in a certain direction, a number of us rebelled. When the Black Watch story, do you remember? Fallujah happened, and the story in our papers was Black Watch. They did not want to talk about Fallujah, they only wanted to talk about our boys. And I feel very sorry for our soldiers. Most of them didn't want this war and don't want it at all anymore. But the story, surely, in terms of our conscience, or even a media narrative could not possibly or should not have been Blackwatching when they come home, when Fallujah was being completely demolished. And we still haven't told the story of Fallujah. We still have not told the proper story of Fallujah. Now, I remember writing this, saying, actually, I'm not interested in Blackwatch. Long may they live. I don't want to get romantic about Blackwatch. I want to know what Blackwatch actually did in Fallujah. That's the story I want to know. And I thought, oh, all right, you know, bunker down. Here he comes, because it always does, you know, the kind of... But it didn't. It didn't. What you got instead were people who were equally appalled. That when there was such an obvious case of collective punishment of a people, how could we be talking about our boys? So that was quite an interesting turning point. And I can only read these things through the... I get about 600 to 800 emails every week, and you can judge things, but only in a very kind of ad hoc way, not as proper research. There are two or three quick other points I want to make. I think what Tim has said is extremely important, but he perhaps should have emphasized something which I will emphasize on his behalf because he will agree with me, I know. It isn't that the Arab voice is missing. It is that there are no bloody Arab journalists employed by the BBC. We have no Arab journalists. Can you imagine what the situation would be like if we were covering what we cover and there was no black journalist? You know, we have fought these battles over how many years. You've got to have people who understand from within, not so that they're biased, but because actually they can tell the story, one side of the story, and then you can tell the other. There isn't a single, as far as I know, please correct me if I'm wrong, but our BBC, which we pay for, has yet not thought it necessary. And we've got brilliant Palestinian lawyers, doctors, businessmen, media students, not one Arab journalist employed by the public service broadcaster. I think this is such a scandalous situation that all of us should immediately go home and write a letter. I've been writing them long enough. Because that was the battle when I began as a journalist to get more black and Asian people into the heart of the corporation, into the heart of where, not just reading the news, that's the PR bit of it, but actually making the decisions and writing the script and giving us the diet that we are then fed at 6 and 10. Two other very quick points. It seems to me that whilst I am very, very proud... Oh, there was one other point, and I also want the BBC to say what they always say when there's news about Zimbabwe. Whenever there's an item about Zimbabwe, the very conscientious BBC tells us, this is coming to you under conditions of censorship. Why do they not tell us that every time they report on Iraq? Okay, it's not censorship in the way we used to understand it. Find the wording. This news comes to you under strictly controlled conditions each time. I think they should be honor-bound to tell us that. But it doesn't happen. And I really think these very practical points would make an enormous difference to how coverage is received. And very quick other points. The extraordinary... dangerous connections that are made by the right-wing press, which is then, I think, sometimes too often picked up these days by the liberal press, who are now terrified of being called liberal. The one thing journalists and journalist organizations today are terrified of being called are two perfectly honorable things. One, that they're politically correct, and B, that they're liberal. They're spending all their time not being politically correct, and now not being liberal so that right-wing people can't accuse them of being liberal. So that even if they are liberal, they have to make dangerously illiberal programs. I think it's very, very important for the BBC to get its nerve back. I think up to a point it has after the Gilligan affair. But also there is a new kind of connection emerging where the war or the wars... that we are losing or winning or whatever, seem to connect to terrorism without question. It seems to me the role of our industry is to question the link between all those people who were arrested at Heathrow, of whom we have heard nothing since, who are going through, some of them, totally secret trials about which we may not know anything. It's a complete travesty of justice as we know it, and yet it seems to me the media has gone completely quiet. That is an area to look at. And then, of course, following from that connection to the wars, the enemy, then you've got terrorism, and, of course, then you've got asylum seekers. And that is the connection that I think is beginning to be one of the most, I think, frightening ones, so that when you talk about asylum seekers, even at dinner parties in Islington, people will talk about terrorism, and then they will talk about suicide bombers. And I think it's a very intangible thing I'm just describing, but I can see it solidifying into something, the kind of, if you like, the storyline for the next year of how the media is going to cover these very important and continuing issues, really. Thank you.
Now, you may, like me, have turned on Radio 4 3 weeks ago, it was a Friday morning, to hear General Sir Richard Dannatt announce that the presence of British troops in Iraq was exacerbating the situation, in other words, making it worse. And my first reaction to that was, but that's just what Sami Ramadani has been saying for the last 3 years. And so I'm very pleased to welcome Sami as our next speaker, a political exile from Saddam's Iraq, and now a senior lecturer at London Metropolitan University, who writes columns in the national papers, and has been consistently and clearly and very convincingly arguing over the last 3 years that the continuation of the occupation of Iraq will make civil war more likely and not less.
Thank you. Sorry, that's all right. Oops. Okay, thanks. Now, one thing that attracts my attention always when I speak about the media is just to pick up the day's news and try and see what they report and what they don't report. And I picked up these items for the past few days. There is an area of Baghdad called Sadr City. Close to 3 million people live there. And it's been under siege now for a week, 7 whole days. The US forces have thrown a ring of steel around it. Not a dicky bird is allowed to leave or enter the neighborhoods of Sadr City. All food supplies are being cut off. Yesterday there was a massive demonstration. Tens of thousands of people in Sadr City went to the streets. Protesting the siege, calling for an end to the occupation, and highlighting the hardships that... And they were calling for an end to the siege because it was causing enormous hardship. So that item has not appeared. Now, this is important in the context of what the US forces are now doing in Baghdad, because about 2 weeks ago, a bit more than 2 weeks maybe, a U.S. soldier was kidnapped, and they're looking for him. Before that, there was a new security operation to pacify Baghdad, because the U.S. forces withdrew from the streets of Baghdad for a while, leaving it to the Iraqi forces to restore so-called order. And obviously all that collapsed. The resistance was growing by the day to the occupation. So the US forces have re-entered Baghdad in a big way in the past few weeks. So there's one American soldier whose gun missing, and they are turning Baghdad into one hell of a place now. Already, obviously, the place was suffering due to the lack of electricity, gas supplies, petrol, you name it, the city is crumbling. Baghdad used to boast of quite an advanced health service. In fact, Iraq in general had a good health service. That's crumbling completely now. Children are not going to school because parents are too frightened to send their kids to school. But what the US forces are doing now in Baghdad is chopping it to bits and trying to encircle each area separately and to attack people's homes and search them, ostensibly searching for the missing soldier. And Baghdad is a city of 6 million people, a great metropolis, and it's being brought down to a level of existence which is really very harsh. So that bit of the news is obviously missing. But the siege about Sadr City connects to a general political problem in Iraq today. If you remember, before they attacked Fallujah, and I'm glad Yasmin mentioned Fallujah, before they destroyed Fallujah, the headlines in the press and the media were full of Zarqawi, and that Zarqawi was actually in Fallujah. This one-legged terrorist popping around all over the place was to be found in Fallujah, nowhere on earth except in Fallujah. And they besieged the city and destroyed it and used chemical weapons. It's to the shame of Paul Wood, who was embedded, BBC journalist, unfortunately, Tim, who was embedded with the US forces. He actually saw phosphorus bombs being used, and he actually denied it, and I've got it recorded that that was the case, but he had to retreat a year later because US soldiers were posting it on the website that they actually used phosphorus bombs in Fallujah. So Zarqawi was the big story, and this was preparation for destroying Fallujah. For the past several months, you might have noticed that the Mahdi army and Sadr's forces are the main culprits in Iraq. And this is distinctly, and this is my reading, my political reading of the situation, is related to a campaign that the US forces have been preparing to destroy the Mahdi army wherever they could. And Sadr City in Baghdad is one of the main support centers for the Mahdi army. I'm not a supporter of the Mahdi army or Sadr or any of these organizations, but I do know that the Mahdi army is probably the largest organized resistance force in the country. This is not often mentioned. They talk about insurgents in so-called Sunni areas, but the Mahdi army, although has a nominal ceasefire with the occupation forces, still poses the biggest headache for the US forces in terms of controlling Baghdad and much of southern Iraq. So the news becomes of sectarian strife, with Shia killing Sunni, Sunni killing Shia, and we get lost in this maze of a sectarian conflict, while the poor occupation forces benignly and so charitably watching events and trying to keep the sides from destroying each other. Now, this is quite strange because for well over 1,000 years, these communities lived together. Iraq has not witnessed a communal civil war in its history. It could be an accident of history, but this is true. You go and read all the history books, you will find no history of communal civil war. We had repressive regimes, we had dictatorships, we had armies killing Kurdish people or inflicting pain on people in the south, mostly Shia, or in the center, mostly Sunni, and so forth. But we have not had communities at loggerhead killing each other. We've had maybe countries which have passed through periods of civil war, including, for example, the Lebanon, its old feudal order meant that each feudal lord had private armies and they used to mobilize on the basis of sect and religion and so forth. But we haven't had this. And why, after 1,000 years or more, people suddenly decide to kill each other is quite interesting. In 2006, Blair and Bush tried to convince us that if they withdraw, Iraqis will kill each other by the million. this is nonsensical. And I tell you, and I say this, and I know on Newsnight the other day I was challenged on this. Jerry Paxson told me that you're sitting in London, you're saying if they withdraw, there will not be such a civil war. I say this from deep knowledge of Iraq. I say this from all the contacts I have in Iraq. The occupation is not only exasperating the violence in Iraq, but their political presence in the country is extremely divisive. And this is what doesn't get reported quite often, that this weight, this occupation, shouldn't just be talked about in terms of soldiers on the ground being the targets of violence and they themselves committing violence against the population. But their political presence is poisonous. They are poisoning the political body within Iraq. They have done this before the invasion, before the occupation, and they are doing it after the occupation. They did it after the occupation. Before the occupation, they had the so-called London Conference. Khalil Zad, the ambassador now in Baghdad, supervised that conference of so-called Iraqi opposition groups, and he dealt with them and organized them on the basis of sect, ethnicity, and religion. Every single political force that attended that conference in a hotel in Edgware Road was told that you represent this sect, that ethnicity, and that religion. That was before the invasion. After the invasion, and Khalil Zad is a political expert on Iraq, that's why he's now the ambassador there. Immediately after Negroponte was the expert on terrorism, as you know. After the occupation, they formed the Iraqi Governing Council, and the Iraqi Governing Council was strictly divided by Paul Bremer, the then US ruler in Iraq, on sectarian, ethnic divisions and religious divisions. Even the Secretary General of the Iraqi Communist Party, which did a flip-flop and supported the formation of the Iraqi Governing Council by the occupation forces. The leader of that party was told by Paul Bremer he is on the council as a Shia, not as a communist. And that was quite important. And so he himself appeared on telly. He said, yes, I might be communist, but I'm also Shia. How you could reconcile the two, I leave it to you. So their presence within Iraqi politics is extremely divisive. They are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on sectarian propaganda and sectarian Iraqi organizations. And they have another presence which does not attract the headlines and in the media. The formation of secret militias. And this is something probably all my colleagues and you might have noticed. Certain items appear in the press and disappear. Nobody follows them up for some reason or other. This item appeared in the Wall Street Journal more than a year ago, detailing how the US has formed at least 11 secret militia forces in the country. One of them at the time was 10,000 strong, led by a former Saddam general by the name of Adnan Thabit, and that the US forces were extremely happy with that general because his militia were helping them conquer various resistance strongholds and so forth. The same character is now appointed as the head of the Iraqi police. The secret militias that they organize, they pay for, they train and so on are still in the country. What do they exactly do, what sort of activities they carry is highly, highly secretive, but their existence is there. Another item that hit only once it appeared and it disappeared, US and secret gun deal. This is reference to an Amnesty International report that again was buried deep in the underground. The United States, which occupies Iraq, has smuggled into Iraq 200,000 Kalashnikovs, an enormous quantity of explosives. They actually smuggled it using private companies in Bosnia. So they smuggled the arms, Kalashnikovs, Russian supplies and so on, and explosives into the country. And they are refusing to say who they gave it to. They distributed it inside the country, inside Iraq, and they are not telling people who they have given these arms to. 200,000 weapons. So you can see how the occupation's presence, from a number of indicators, whether political, military, their activities on the ground, the hundreds of millions of dollars they are spending on sectarian setups, is extremely poisonous. It is this that, if it continues, and this has been my argument for the last few years, that the longer they stay, the greater the violence and not. And this is being proven in practice day in, day out. So why should we start speculating that Iraqis will kill each other and their millions once these guys withdraw? It doesn't make sense. They want to distract people from the main problem. And the main problem in Iraq, that there is an occupation which is hated by most people. Even the Ministry of Defense here did its own research inside Iraq and found last year that was 82% of Iraqis wanted the troops out of Iraq. The latest opinion poll carried by the University of Maryland again found well over 80% of Iraqis want the troops out. And significantly, according to this survey, 60% of Iraqis now support armed attacks against the occupation forces. And that university regards that shift as extremely important because it involves even 16% of the Kurdish people now support armed activities against the occupation forces. Have I got 2 minutes left?
Two minutes.
Okay. Now, there are many sources of violence in Iraq. If you just count them quickly, you can imagine the scene. And much of this scene is nothing to do with sectarian divisions. You've got about 150,000 occupation forces, about 50,000 mercenaries, totally above Iraqi law. There are foreign mercenaries brought in. Some were involved in fighting in South Africa, Chile. All the gangsters and fascist thugs and expertise on murder and killings have been brought into Iraq through these private companies, numbering, according to War and Want, in today's press, numbering about 48,000. Totally outside Iraqi law, because Paul Bremer issued his last decree was to absolve them and put them beyond Iraqi law. They and the occupation forces are outside of Iraqi jurisdiction completely. 160,000 force, this is called the Facilities Protection Services. This is a very dangerous force, armed, trained, and dominated by US generals, paid for by the Iraqi government. Although they are paid by the government, their training and control are by US generals. This is an important force because two people in Iraq have now declared that they are involved in death squad activities. One of them was the former interior minister, but more significantly, Iraq's current prime minister, 3 weeks ago, about 4 weeks now, in fact, declared that this force is heavily involved in death squads activities. Now, 160,000, this is outside of the so-called Iraqi forces there, training and so on, engaged in death squad. This is an army in the country. You don't need to look into sects and sectarianism to see that the country is awash with organized forces. This must be the first civil war in history. They call it civil war, and I refuse to call it a civil war, in which people who kill each other are still masked and don't tell each other who they are. Communal civil wars are usually declared, it's your neighbor, it's your friend, it is communities going into a clash against each other. There is no such phenomena, believe me, in Iraq today. Even in the worst areas where there is a lot of sectarian killings, there is sectarianism, there is sectarian killing, but it is not of a communal nature. It is masked men who come in the middle of the night with their four-wheel drives and well organized, they attack people's homes and kill who they kill and kidnap who they kidnap. This is not a communal civil war. This is organized violence, and I point the finger at the occupation forces. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. With that, I'd like to introduce our final speaker, who's the General Secretary of the NUJ. The NUJ, right from the start of the War on Terror, has had a brilliant position on the war, which has been thrashed out and debated at its national conference every year, and the Union's General Secretary has been a committed and tireless campaigner against the war. He's Jeremy Beal.
Well, can I thank and congratulate Media Workers Against the War for organising tonight's meeting. We need to do more of this kind of stuff to spread the message that you've heard from all the speakers tonight. Normally in an event like this, I might be expected to praise the Morning Star, but tonight I'd like to praise the Daily Star, or more accurately, as you heard from Steve, the Daily Star workers, who last week struck a blow for anti-racism and against the increasingly inaccurate stereotypes masquerading as journalism in some sections of our media. As Steve himself said, it's an unlikely setting for the front line of the struggle against Islamophobia and for workers' rights, but journalists at the Daily Star have shown in one single action how a well-organised trade union can develop power in the workplace. But more than that, the best way to deliver in action the fine words which underpin our industry codes of conduct. 10 days ago, the Daily Star planned to run this, the Daily Fatwa page, as offensive a piece of anti-Muslim prejudice bordering on incitement to violence and racial hatred as you could ever wish to see. Loosely dressed up as a spoof, the page would not have been out of place in any BNP publication. Faced with working on the page, the paper's union members refused and asked the editors to withdraw the article. A union meeting was called and a motion passed unanimously, threatening further action if the page was not withdrawn. A few hurried phone calls between senior managers, lawyers and the deputy editor who was in charge that night resulted in the momentous decision, and the page was dropped. The first time, I believe, a page dropped because of workers' action in a national newspaper since the 1984-5 miners' strike and action by the printers during that. And we should be enormously proud of the actions of those at the Daily Star. And judging by the flood of messages of support that we and they have received, we are, and many others are too. Yasmin talked about us being proud. Well, as journalists and media workers, we should be both proud and ashamed at the media coverage of the bloody conflicts that have claimed more than 800,000 lives in the name of the war on terror. Proud that in incredibly difficult circumstances, facing threats and deliberate targeting, censorship, both official and unofficial, covert and overt, hardy journalists have been able to bring us some small sense of the horrors unfolding in Afghanistan, in Iraq and southern Lebanon, of the families massacred, of the killing of children in so-called precision bombing, of the homes, the bridges, the hospitals, the workplaces, the cars bombed and destroyed, and of the conditions faced by more than 500,000 refugees following attacks on medical trucks and water and electricity supplies, of the lack of electricity and sanitation in towns whose whole infrastructure has been destroyed, and some small sense too of the collective punishment being meted out to the Iraqi, Afghan, Lebanese and Palestinian people. And we should be proud of those who seek to contribute to a greater understanding of the issues behind each of those conflicts, like one of the reports by David Loyne from Afghanistan referred to earlier, now so shamefully attacked by politicians from all sides, or journalists like Terry Lloyd, unlawfully killed by US troops, or 154 other journalists seeking only to contribute a greater understanding of what was happening in the particular conflicts that they were covering. People like these represent all that is best about journalism, the search for truth, the presentation of facts to enable citizens to participate in the democratic process, and the holding to account of power and authority. And there can be no more important time for those fundamental values to be shown than during a war, in the lead up to such a conflict, or here at home, when our own government tells us that the price of freedom at home is rendition flights and the suspension and curtailment of our civil liberties and our individual freedoms. And that's why we should not only be proud, but ashamed too. Ashamed, yes, of a government and the lies it told, which led us into an illegal and immoral war. And just in case you need reminding, I brought my trusty prop with me, the day of the dodgy dossier, 45 minutes from attack, with full of maps of where was going to be obliterated within 45 minutes of Saddam Hussein launching his attack. But ashamed too that much of the media coverage accepted those lies as truth, that much of the media coverage has been unbalanced, took abstract notions of balance and applied them, as Tim said, to a conflict between unequal partners, the occupier and the occupied, and that it relied too much on stereotypes and sensationalism, on official sources, and as with Iraq and the lurch to war with Iran or Syria, fails in its duty to sufficiently rigorously question and hold to account those who speak and act in our name. Some people think that censorship and the muzzling of the media is something that happens only in faraway dictatorships. Of course, it is not. It happens when the MOD bans embeds in retaliation for ITN journalists exposing the plight of injured UK soldiers. It happens when Sir Ray Tyndall claims he's preventing his 120-plus newspapers from taking sides in the war in Iraq by banning the publication of anti-war reports, photos, or readers' letters. It happens when US troops identify media personnel and kill them in cold blood, as they did with Terry Lloyd. It happens when the BBC sends out memos restricting so-called anti-war extremists from appearing on phone-ins and chat shows. And it happens when we accept editorial guidelines which avoid the use of the word terrorism when referring to state armies, but apply it indiscriminately to those who defend their homes. And it happens when the government pass sweeping laws banning the glorification of terrorism, or threaten to tighten the Official Secrets Act to ensure whistleblowers face greater penalties for exposing government lies. It happens when troops fire on satellite positions, attack radio and TV stations, set up funded newspapers in Iraq, and then sack the staff when they refuse to toe the editorial line of their military paymasters, or when radio stations ban songs and plays and films are axed. But it happens, perhaps most worryingly, when we stop asking questions, when we stop standing up to the censors, when we stop upholding the finest traditions of journalism, when the chilling effect of the censors and the threats succeed and it becomes self-censorship and fear. But as Steve pointed out, I think, we can only stand up when we feel strong enough to do so. That's why meetings like this are important. They give us renewed strength. They remind us of our public duty. They underline our vital role in a democratic society. And they send a warning to those who would undermine those values that we are both watching and organising to defend the integrity and the independence of our work. But meetings are not enough. It's vital we take tonight's messages from here to our colleagues, to our newsrooms and build on our work. As Dave said, organise meetings like this in your workplace. Take the leaflets that are here and organise around those. Get involved in Media Workers Against the War. Take the petitions and get them signed and send them back. Yes, protest about bad media coverage, but also praise good media coverage. Join the campaign and join the relevant unions. And leave here with one commitment. Written large in the preface to our union's rules is a commitment to peace and social justice. We have to understand there will be no peace and no social justice in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Afghanistan until the occupation is ended.
One of the problems with having such a fantastic panel of speakers tonight is that we've really gone on, I think, long enough, and so I'm afraid I'm not going to take questions from the floor. Hopefully, if the speakers don't run away immediately, they'll be here to ask questions if you want to come up to speak to them individually. So I'm going to close the meeting now. It just remains for me to say, make sure you've left us your contact details, make sure you've taken away the material that's at the back. And personally, I found tonight's combination of speakers both uplifting and inspiring and informing, and that's a unique and valuable combination. Could you please say thank you one more time to our speakers? And